Good morning. My name is Frank Dravis, and you are listening to WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guests are Carol Abrahamson, Executive Director, and Abby Church, Conservation Director for Mississippi Valley Conservancy. How are you doing, Carol?
Good morning, Frank.
How about you, Abby?
Hi, Frank. Great to be here.
Excellent. Carol, why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of the Conservancy for our audience? If I use the terms Conservancy or MVC, I am indeed referring to Mississippi Valley Conservancy. So, Carol, how about that sketch?
Well, I am the executive director at the Conservancy, as you mentioned. So just overseeing the organization in general, supporting the staff and the board members. I've been with the Conservancy since 2011. And prior to that, I'm also a farmer on the side and worked in the beef industry and spent a number of years just raising my children.
So what attracted you to the Conservancy?
The work that the Conservancy does really brings full circle the work that we do on our farm. So I feel like, you know, I get up in the morning and I do my chores, say good morning to the pigs, give them their breakfast, etc. And then I jump in the car and I drive along the backwaters of the Mississippi, cross that big old river and head into the office, work during the day on supporting our land protection and conservation efforts. And then I get in the car and I get to cross that beautiful river once again, back along those backwaters and up onto the ridgetop to our farm where, you know, finish up the chores, pick some things out of the garden, make dinner. It's just a full circle for me and for my lifestyle.
So you're seeing it firsthand, conservation efforts, living with the land, et cetera?
Correct, yes. Our farm is small, and so we have quite a lot of habitat, forested land, and also just grasslands that support all of the critters that we love to enjoy.
Abby, how about you? What's your role at the Conservancy?
My role is Conservation Director, and I've been with the Conservancy for 17 years. I started out as Conservation Specialist and am now really excited to have the opportunity to lead a team of habitat management and land protection professionals in doing the work that we do.
So, do I know that you have intense knowledge of biology in the ecosystem and that sort of stuff?
Yes, and everyone on our team has different specializations. I'd have to say mine is plants and botany.
Plants and botany. So, Carol, what was the high-level genesis for the start of the Conservancy? Who started it and why?
There was a group of folks who were friends, longtime friends, and they were just talking and visiting together, looking across the river toward the blufflands in Minnesota, and they noticed that development was happening on those bluffs. And that became a big concern as they looked upward toward the La Crosse blufflands. They wanted to make sure that that did not happen in La Crosse. And so they talked about it and they said, well, hey, let's just contact the Nature Conservancy and let them know that we have this really special place and we want to make sure that they're working to protect it. Well, the Nature Conservancy said, that's a fantastic idea, but it's just not an area that we work in, and encouraged that group of folks to found their own land trust, which, as we all know, then became Mississippi Valley Conservancy.
So what are the, I can assume, but let you spell it out for me, is what are the two or three roles that the Conservancy serves?
We've got three primary areas that we work in. Our highest priority is land protection and conservation with private landowners. We also have a number of nature preserves that are open to the public, so habitat management is our second role, and the third is community outreach and environmental education and ensuring people know and understand opportunities in this area for conservation projects.
Good. I think we'll be able to talk about all three of those. Is the Conservancy a nonprofit or is it for profit? What's the general financial structure?
Yes, it is a 501c3 nonprofit, supported primarily just by individuals who really care deeply about the Driftless area and want to support the work that we do.
Okay. With the pullback in funding for so many things at the federal level, how has that impacted the Conservancy, in how have you found sustainability of the Conservancy progressing in this modern era, if you will?
There has been some impact with the federal dollars. As many of you know, we did reach out to our base of supporters when we needed help funding our AmeriCorps position. So that was, we had hired Emily. She was coming from New Hampshire. We were all really excited. And just a couple of days later, that funding was pulled. And when we talked about it, we said, you know what? This is really important. Emily is counting on us. We need to just step up, do the right thing, and hire her, and have faith that folks will join us in stepping up and providing that funding that we needed. And it happened. We sent out a couple of emails explaining the situation, and we raised everything that we needed to support Emily in her AmeriCorps position here with Mississippi Valley Conservancy. We do depend a bit on federal dollars for some of our restoration work, but really the majority of support that we get comes from our individual donors, some granting from foundations, certainly some county and state conservation funding, and also we have businesses who are really generous supporters and partners of ours that help to round out our budget.
So I've heard of AmeriCorps. When you say for the AmeriCorps position, what is that? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. Every summer, Frank, we hire 8 summer interns, and these are young college folks who are exploring conservation careers. They are hired to come and help us in the field. They spend 30 hours a week going out to the properties that our generous supporters have protected, and also helping our landowners who have protected their own properties with a conservation easement. So they spend some of their time helping those folks on their projects as well. And a couple of years ago, we also added to that crew an AmeriCorps position. So she is doing the very same work that these summer interns are doing. And it's just, I guess it's twofold. It's our opportunity to offer that young person some experience in the field in conservation, and also an additional opportunity to provide habitat restoration, both on the properties that the Conservancy owns as well as those that the private landowners own and have protected with the conservation agreement with the Conservancy.
So is AmeriCorps, is that an organization or what is that?
Yes, that is an organization, and they do placements in many things, not just conservation. So many, many things. It is an opportunity for, you know, young and not even always really young folks to explore some career avenues and really get a feel for, is this thing that I think that I want to do what I really want to do? Or sometimes they just don't know what they want to do, and so they'll go and try a few AmeriCorps positions and get a taste for what some potential careers for them might be.
And so AmeriCorps may want to place a position or a person with Mississippi Valley Conservancy then?
Yeah, we actually get our placements through WISCORS. They are the AmeriCorps placement agency. I'm not sure okay. If that's the correct terminology, but we're able to apply through them, and then they do some of the support of that AmeriCorps position and a lot of the logistical work.
So I think I remember talking to various members of the Conservancy. Are members the same thing as donors, or what's the use of your term member?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Frank. anybody who supports our organization with even $1 is considered a member. Our members are the people who we send out our newsletters to, our invitations to events to. We have some of our outdoor events that are limited in number, so our members get to sign up for those first. But really what they are is a part of our team. We have a really large team. It involves our staff, it involves volunteers, our board of directors, our landowners, and all of the folks who support us, we consider to be team members.
Hmm. Is there a common demographic to your members? I mean, we're in the Driftless region. I'm curious what kind of walks of life your members may come from.
Another good question. I would say all walks of life. We have people of all ages and backgrounds, but people not just from the Driftless area that are supporting us. We have people from across the United States who support us for various reasons. A lot of times we hear that, oh, I went to college in La Crosse, and yes, I moved away, but I've never forgotten how beautiful it is there, and they'll support us. We've had people who have passed away, and their families have contacted us and said, you know, we really want to make a meaningful gift in memory of our brother who really loved the Driftless area. He went to school there. He later had to move, but we know that it meant a lot to him, and he loved to hike and fish. And so we want to make this gift. So it really varies. Folks who have lived here for a long time and then moved on, or folks who protected their property at one time but then sold it later and moved on, also will continue to support the work that we do.
You know, I've gone on a lot of nature hikes, birding outings through various organizations, and I will oftentimes meet people that live in apartments that seldom get an opportunity to come out and enjoy nature, and that was their opportunity for maybe the month. We've talked about people that live on the land and farms and rural areas and maybe have property themselves. Are urbanites, people who live in apartments, high rises, are they interested in the work the Conservancy does? Are they potential members? What about them?
Absolutely. We get a lot of involvement from urbanites. Our New Amsterdam Grasslands Nature Preserve near Holman has an apartment building right next to it. And we did a prescribed burn this spring. And sure enough, there were people coming out on their decks with their lawn chairs and their cup of coffee to watch us working and watch that burn and shared afterwards how much fun it was and how interesting to see that restoration in progress. They also attend a lot of our guided hikes and educational events to learn more about the work that we do and have that opportunity to go out and explore nature.
Prescribed burns, favorite subject of mine. I'm kind of like a neophyte at that. I need to take some classes on how to do a prescribed burn because I have property of myself. And when we had a drought 2 years ago and there was like 1,500 wildfires in Wisconsin, you know, wildfire being an uncontrolled fire in February, I got really concerned, right? And so I think if we have time, we'll talk a little bit more or ask some questions about what a prescribed burn is and what you do there. But so, Abby, you said you've been a member of the Conservancy for 17 years. How long has the Conservancy been around?
Since 1997.
So do the math for me.
28 years.
28 years. Congratulations. So that means it is sustaining. I mean, there's been a number of environment or economic upturns and downturns in those 28 years, and here we are, you know, talking about the viability, you know, continued interest in our environment. So how the geographical area, where does the Conservancy work in? What is that area for the Conservancy?
We work in 9 counties in southwest Wisconsin. Right now we're sitting in Vernon County for this interview. If you go to the south, we cover Crawford and Grant counties, Richland County, and then circling around to the east and north, Monroe, Jackson, Trempealeau, Buffalo, and La Crosse counties.
Hmm. So, Carol, you told me the story of the founders looking at the bluffs. So, is that the reason? I mean, the Triflis region is special for a lot of reasons. And so as unique as it is, why was the Conservancy started here in the Driftless region? Because that's where they lived?
Yes, that's where they lived and what they truly cared about. But quite frankly, once they got started, it went way beyond the bluffs. The Conservancy was interested in making sure that we have the bluff prairies, but just also regular prairies. Farmland is being protected, forests, and beyond just the protection, one of the sometimes unique to land trusts work that we do is also the restoration of the habitat. So we don't just acquire a property and then let it be. We work really hard to restore it to native habitat, and Abby can talk way more than I can about that, but just that distinction of making sure that we are being the best caretakers of that land.
Yeah, and I think I'm stacking up a whole bunch of questions for you, Abby. But first, let me ask, Carol, how many land trusts are there in Wisconsin?
There are approximately 40 or so land trusts in Wisconsin. Some of them are very small. They might just focus on one small area or even property, one county. And then there's one as large as focusing on 20 counties. We're sort of in the middle with the 9 counties that we cover.
Hmm. How many land trusts are there in the U.S.?
There's a close to 1,300 land trusts in the U.S.
Wow, so land trusts are popular or at least common then?
I think the word you're looking for, Frank, is necessary. There is a need, and the land trust movement is one that organizations are formed to fill that need.
So is there some sort of organization that these land trusts work with? I mean, the kind of standardized practices, or is it wild, wild west out there? Or how do they cooperate?
Yes, there's a lot of organization that is going on. Mississippi Valley Conservancy belongs to a state association called Gathering Waters, and they support all of the land trusts in Wisconsin. But we also have a larger organization that's nationwide called the Land Trust Alliance. In fact, Abby and I just returned yesterday from a conference in Ohio that is a gathering of all these land trusts across the United States. And it's a place where we go to learn from one another about the best practices for our organizations. But beyond that, the Land Trust Alliance does have standards and practices that land trusts can and should follow, and they have the opportunity to become accredited land trusts through the Land Trust Alliance. And in that case, you not only have to follow these standards and practices, but there is a rigorous application process to become accredited, which we are, and also every 5 years we have to have that accreditation renewed. And that, once again, there is a commission that is combing through all of our information and making sure that we are, doing what we should do regarding those standards and practices.
So formal, so legal organization, right?
Correct.
All right, so I know that you operate in the 9 counties of the Driftless area. Can you kind of give me a sketch of what are the properties that the Conservancy manages? I mean, do you have your own properties? Are these just landowner properties? Give me an idea what kind of properties that you work with.
Both. We have lands that we own and manage outright, and those areas are open to the public for hiking, bird watching, hunting, fishing, canoeing, and other low-impact nature-based outdoor recreation. And then we also have properties that involve conservation easements with private landowners. So by the numbers, we've done, since our beginning in 1997, we've done 214 total projects. 137 of those are conservation easements, and 40 of those are nature preserves.
So nature preserve, I have a firm notion in my head of what a nature preserve is, but why don't you tell me what a nature preserve is?
Nature preserve, some of the lands that are nature preserves we own and are available to showcase our restoration activities, wildlife habitat, different natural communities, and are open to the public. Some of those nature preserves are owned by a partner. So it's sites that we have acquired and then transferred to, say, a municipality like the City of Onalaska or the Town of Holland, or transferred to a partner such as the Prairie Enthusiasts or the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Management Board. So in those cases, a partner entity owns and manages the property, and we retain a conservation easement for the permanent protection of those natural resources.
So I did read about the about Onalaska, but before I talk, before I ask questions about that, let me just make sure we do a station break here. And I want to say good morning to all of our listeners. My name is Frank Dravis, and you are listening to WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guests are Carol Abrahamson, Executive Director, and Abby Church, Conservation Director of Mississippi Valley Conservancy. So you manage a mix of private land and conservancy owned. Is that correct? So 214 projects. Are that is that equivalent to parcels?
Yes, and that also includes so a site like Sugar Creek Bluff State Natural Area in Ferryville. It's one property. We consider it one nature preserve, but it was put together with multiple individual parcels that were acquired over time. So it's multiple parcels, but one nature preserve.
Okay, I've actually been to Sugar Creek. I did a birding hike there one time. Beautiful property. So that's one property now, but there was multiple properties that came together to make it.
Correct.
Oh, nice. So when you protect a parcel, what do you look for in that parcel, be it private, public land, if it's going to be a private easement that you're going to work with the landowner, or if you want to acquire it yourself, what do you look for?
Every parcel we look at, we prioritize. We do a sort of triage in looking at how high of a priority it is from a conservation perspective. The things that we look at are the size of the property, if it's contiguous with other protected lands or adjacent to, say, state or county lands, the biodiversity, the ecological values of that site, and if it's a very healthy natural community or if it has populations of threatened or endangered species. We also protect farmland, so we're looking for sites that have good conservation practices, good soil health. Water resources are another thing that we look at. If a property has wetlands, springs, creeks, rivers, all of those things that help protect water quality. And overall, we also look at if a property is in a priority area of ours or a priority area of a partner's. And an example of that would be the Wisconsin DNR has conservation opportunity areas that are identified as high priority for conservation efforts. Or if a farm is within the county's farmland preservation plan boundary or an important bird area or other things like that. We also look at historical, cultural, and archaeological resources as another priority of resources to protect.
Archaeological. Are there, give me an example, something along the archaeological area?
An archaeological area that we have protected would include Eagle Eye State Natural Area right here in Vernon County. And that's a site that has Native American effigy mounds and other historical records. There's a Native American rock shelter on that property. So things that are important to the people of Wisconsin, to the local community to protect.
Hmm, interesting. So if a private landowner were to come to the Conservancy, you know, and they have an interest and they want to protect their land from development, how would you help them?
The first step is to have a conversation about what that landowner's vision for the property is, what they see as the best case scenario for their land, and then kind of talk through the options of what could be done as far as a conservation easement or donated land, or if there is another option available. Just talking through how that would look is how we would help them. If they were interested in a conservation easement, for example, that's an excellent tool to keep land in private ownership and prevent future uses that would damage the habitat or eliminate the farmland capabilities of that property, such as residential development or mining.
So, you know, I've heard of transportation easements where like the county or the Department of Transportation would have an easement across the property, or the power company would have an easement right away for their power lines. How would this easement work?
Conservation easement is a very specific legal mechanism. It's a legal document that identifies the conservation values of a property, such as the soils, the geological, the watershed, the habitat values, and places restrictions permanently to ensure that those specific values remain in place.
Hmm. So does the landowner still own the land? Can they still use it?
Yes, the landowner still owns the land. And depending on the type of conservation easement, it might be a farmland preservation easement. So in that case, there would be areas designated for continued agricultural use with other areas where agricultural use might be prohibited.
Well, so a lot of times my wife and I will have conversations. You know, at one time there was an easement for our a quarry company on our property, and it expired some years ago. And I remember there was a number of misconceptions about that easement. And are there kind of misconceptions that you might hear about or experience from people that are interested in joining the Conservancy?
Yes, there's a number of misperceptions about conservation easements. I think the biggest one that we run into is the idea that if we hold an easement on the land, it has to be open to public access, and that's not true. Land continues to be privately owned unless a person wants to open public access, but that remains the landowner's decision. We do not require public access for a conservation easement.
So it would seem to me that if you're going to place an easement or land use restriction on a piece of property, that would have some sort of impact on the property value.
Property value is a very case-by-case situation. For example, if a conservation easement prohibited residential development, but the property itself was a wetland or a very steep bluff where it wasn't particularly developable, it may not affect the property value, whereas another site that's more flat or flat and dry, it may have a significant impact on the property value.
So if there's a land use restriction placed on a prairie that may have been an ideal apartment complex with great view of the Mississippi River right from the bluff, and the landowner, say the property might have been worth $500,000 before they put on the easement, could they get a tax break for that, or is that even possible?
There is an income tax incentive for conservation easements. You asked earlier about misperceptions about easements. One of the biggest misperceptions is that it will affect property taxes. And typically, property taxes don't change if you're taxed at an agricultural use valuation and it's a farmland preservation easement. That would stay the same. But there is a federal income tax incentive for that easement based on the value of the restrictions placed on the property.
Yeah, I think I heard a while ago from some friends of mine, they complained that a person had put an easement on their property just to reduce their tax burden, and they were complaining about that. So I suppose, could there be that kind of connotation where people might want to do this just for the tax break?
I think that's possible, and that's something that any landowner interested in the income tax incentive should talk with their accountant to see. It affects everyone differently, and every property is valued differently.
Okay, so let's turn to one subject near and dear to my heart, and that is how to actually protect the land. You know, the ecosystem conservation. If someone wants to learn more about restoring native habitat on their property, I mean, it seems like you do quite a bit of work here. What's your advice?
The first step that I would recommend is to join Mississippi Valley Conservancy as a member, to become part of this community that we have of people passionate about restoring native habitat. It also allows a person to receive our newsletter and our e-news, which includes opportunities to attend work parties to learn from skilled conservation professionals about different habitat management techniques, and to have that one-on-one opportunity to ask our team for advice on different practices and procedures. We're always learning new things about habitat management on any given day or any given topic. There's new research coming out, new grant funding opportunities available, so it's changing all of the time, and just interacting with our team is a great way to learn more.
Well, I can imagine that private landowners who have their own property, there's probably a myriad of things that they want to do on their land, and we can talk about that. I know deer stands are a popular thing in deer hunting country, right? I know I've got more than a few on my property, but for the land that the conservation or the conservancy owns, let's back up just a little bit. How many parcels does a conservancy own?
We own 5,655 acres.
Wow. Okay, so how many different properties, just thumbnail sketch, how many different properties might that be?
There are 40 nature preserves in our 9-county area.
So in those 40 nature preserves, what does the conservancy usually do on those preserves? So Carol mentioned that you don't just let the land sit there. Okay, fine. What do you do with the land?
Every single property that we own has its own management plan, and every year we put together an annual work plan for what our vision is for that property. As a land trust, we're looking at the long view of what is this land going to look like in 10 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years down the road. Our vision for each of those sites is that they are an example to the local community of a certain habitat type, whether it's dry prairie or wetland or hemlock relict or algefic talus slope, that it's a place people can go to learn about very specific natural ecological communities and wildlife species that might be unique to that site. And it's also an opportunity for people to learn management techniques, management practices, and every single property that we're managing is an opportunity to see a different stage in restoration. There's always that stage where You've just gotten started, so it's not quite what you want it to look like or not quite a shining example of that natural community, but it's a work in progress. And I feel that opportunity gives landowners hope that even if you're just beginning on your land management journey, it may not look like what you pictured in your head, but that's okay because you're working towards a vision of what you want it to look like.
So I remember in my bird hike at Sugar Creek, there's obviously a trail, and I think our guide talked about there was prairie restoration that took place. When they said prairie restoration, what were they meaning when they said prairie restoration?
Prairie restoration typically means that historically that site was a prairie and has the remnant species that should be there, but there's something that's preventing them from flourishing. In this area, we're in a very disturbance-dependent landscape, so we need things like prescribed fire or tree and brush removal to help the health of that prairie. It won't get there naturally or without active management. A lot of times fire has been suppressed in this area. And so if fire has been suppressed for a very long time, it may be too late for fire alone to be the management tool. So there we would go in with chainsaws or loppers and brush cutters and manually remove trees and brush that have encroached into that prairie. At the same time, there's invasive species that have come in, things like spotted knapweed or Canada thistle, where we also use herbicide to apply and control those, or manual pulling and other control techniques. So every property has a very long list of the things to do.
That's got to be a daunting list.
Yes, it's one of the most intimidating parts of the conservation community is just there is never enough time in the day to get all of the things done that you want to get done.
Well, I'm really interested to know where you get the manpower or people power to do that work, but let me first ask this question. My pet peeve for invasives, and the top three on my list is Japanese knotweed, wild parsnip, and honeysuckle. And I've gotten ahead of my wild parsnip. It doesn't really like to be mowed, and so repeated mowings have, this year I really saw some benefit of really kept the wild parsnip down, even though I'll drive around the county, Vernon County here, with my friends, and we will point out, particularly in July, oh, look at all that wild parsnip. It's like run amok in so many ditches or verdant fields. The Japanese knotweed, I'm struggling with my Japanese knotweed. You can pull that all you want, but it's a real danger or risk to my buildings. And the honeysuckle, I don't know if I'll ever get caught up on that. What are the top, what you mentioned a couple invasive species. Which ones are you battling with the most on your properties?
It depends on the natural community of the property itself, and especially if there are threatened or endangered species on that property that are threatened. So we do a risk analysis of what our highest priority is so that we can determine where to spend our resources. We really, really strive to engage the local community in helping on those opportunities, and especially by volunteering on our nature preserves, it is our hope that people then go home and identify what's in their backyard to slow the spread of these different invasive species.
Okay, so you have the opportunity for people to come out and volunteer.
Yes. Our website, MississippiValleyConservancy.org, does have an events page that you can click on to find different volunteer opportunities in the area.
Okay. Do they need any training, or do they need to bring their own tools, or what?
No training or tools are necessary, though if a person has their own chainsaws, brush cutters, they are welcome to bring them. We welcome that expertise. And if they don't have that expertise, we are really happy to share what we know and provide on-site training.
Excellent. Let me do a station break here. I just want to say good morning to our listeners. My name is Frank Dravis, and you are listening to WDRT Conversations 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guests are Carol Abrahamson, Executive Director, and Abby Church, Conservation Director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. So the climate change, have you, particularly in your 17 years, Abby, have you noticed the impacts of climate change on the properties the Conservancy manages and the practices you employ? Have you noticed anything?
Yes. The most significant impact that we have noticed has been the heavy rain events, more flooding issues, and more tornadoes. Two of our nature preserves have been impacted by tornadoes, which we've had to then update our management plan because it really makes a difference when you have all of those trees that have blown down on a site to what your management priorities are.
Hmm. Flooding. Erosion, then.
Yes. Flooding, erosion, new invasive species. There's new things coming into the area every year, and a big impact of that is this year it was a lot warmer in February, and we had those extreme temperature changes, and that affects what species thrive here, whether invasive or native.
Mm.
On the flip side, our prescribed burn season for springtime was able to start a lot earlier because we didn't have snow on the ground, which was very unusual this past year.
Okay. I recently, I think I heard in the news that the Conservancy had transferred some property. Did I get that right, Carol? Transferred property to the city of Onalaska?
That is correct.
How did that work?
We have a partnership with the city of Onalaska called the Onalaska Natural Land Protection Program, and we partner with a lot of municipalities, Onalaska, the town of Holland, the city of La Crosse. With Onalaska in particular, when they went through the comprehensive planning process, they identified a greenway boundary, and within that greenway, we have overlapping priorities. The city likes to conserve green space for the health of the local community, places for people to recreate and enjoy nature. And for the Conservancy's perspective, a lot of these parcels meet our priorities as well. So our recent transfer involved two donations of land to us, and then we transferred them to the city of Onalaska to own and manage, and we retain a conservation easement on it to ensure that those lands can never be developed or used for an incompatible use.
So did the city want that property to manage as part of the city, or I'm just curious why? There was probably synergies here where it was better for the city to have it than the Conservancy to have it. What was the kind of partnership give and take there?
The partnership was what we bring to the table is the ability to identify the natural communities and conservation values and facilitate that acquisition of land, complete that real estate transaction. And the Onalaska Parks Department has the ability to manage that land for the benefit of the properties and the local community.
So you're actually providing some early expertise that maybe the city didn't have the time to do. I'm just kind of paraphrasing. And once you identified the property, acquired it, then the city's core strengths could take over and provide labor, if you will. I mean, because you've got 40 properties of your own.
Correct. And since we just transferred the, it was 80 acres to the city, and since that time they have already put in a new trailhead and parking area, so they have jumped right on that property and taken care of it.
They've got a vested, I mean, it's not like you don't have a vested interest, but they have a vested interest because it's right there in their city, close to it, and they can feed that into their plan for all of their parks.
Yes, and the parcel in question is adjacent to other city-owned land, so it helps to continue that contiguous corridor of protected habitat.
So what other organizations do you partner with?
How much time do you have this morning?
Well, I think we probably have 10, 15 minutes left, but hit the highlights.
We have partnerships all over the place. We partner with the Nature Conservancy, the Wisconsin DNR, municipalities, Friends of the Blufflands, the Prairie Enthusiasts, the Monarch Joint Venture, Savannah Institute, Mississippi Valley Archaeology, American Farmland Trust, Fish and Wildlife Service, Wisconsin Wetlands Association. We just had an event this weekend with the National Deer Association. We partner with educational entities such as the University of Wisconsin or Viterbo. There's a lot of partnerships on a lot of different aspects of the work that we do.
That's very encouraging. I mean, I don't personally, not enough can be done to protect the local environment. Climate change, things are changing, and binding these organizations together into some form of relationships, I think, just strengthens everyone. So for your members, to sum up then, what are the benefits of the members? I just want to make sure we cover that point.
A donation of any amount makes you a member. So that's how you join. You can do that on our website. Again, MississippiValleyConservancy.org. It's pretty easy to donate that way. You can also drop a check in the mail. On our website, there's information how to or where to mail that check to. The folks who are supporting us will get our twice monthly e-news. They will get our print newsletters. We have one in the fall, one in the spring, and also our annual report that comes out midwinter. What is specifically special, though, is the invitations. So all of our members are going to receive invitations to special events that we have that sometimes just get too full to accommodate all of the public. So they get the first opportunity to RSVP their interest in coming to an event. We have one particular Link to the Land event in July. It is in our Kickapoo Caverns property. It is a guided tour through the caverns. Very popular. I believe we ran 120 people through that on one Saturday in July this year. That is one that I would say sells out, even though we don't charge anything for our events.
You don't charge for it?
We do not. No. We do not. Our Link to the Land events are all of our guided hikes and events throughout the year, and those are free of charge. But it's also an opportunity if you've attended one of those and you're not a member, perhaps at that point you would want to become a member because you appreciate that work. So those are some of the benefits. But I think beyond that, Frank, it's just really knowing that you belong to this community of people who care so deeply about our Driftless area. You are on our team, whether you are a person who is able to provide the financial support or you come out and volunteer. And that can be on the land, of course, but even in the office, we need volunteers. And if you volunteer for 10 hours in a given year, you get a free membership for doing that as well.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes. So it's just being a part of this big team and this big community of people who care.
So maybe they're disabled or maybe they just don't oftentimes have the chance to get outdoors and volunteer outdoors. You mentioned something about office?
Yes. We do multiple mailings throughout the year. Those mailings can be anywhere from a letter to a member who we're asking them to just renew their support. Of course, like all nonprofits, we do a couple of appeals a year. So those are larger mailings. But beyond that, people who have computer skills, who are interested in helping with some of the organization of files, or have good skills in Excel spreadsheets are helpful as well. We've had people who have decided that they want to spend 2 or 3 hours every week on a certain day at a certain time volunteering in our office. In that case, we can put together longer-term projects for those people too. The best way to volunteer, if you haven't already, to sign up on our website. There is a form that you fill out. Of course, you're providing your contact information, but you're also providing to us where your interests lie in volunteering, because we don't want to contact you to go out to one of our work parties and pull garlic mustard for 4 hours if you are only interested in coming into the office and, say, folding letters and putting them in envelopes. So we're going to really customize your invitation to volunteer to what you've shown us that you're interested in helping with.
Well, I know my wife has got a huge garden, and she loves weeding. So 4 hours of pulling garlic mustard might be right up her alley, but not so much for me. So, are there regularly scheduled events that the Conservancy holds?
Yes.
And if so, how would people find out about them?
Yes, great question. Again, our website, MississippiValleyConservancy.org, is where you can find all of our events. And that includes the Link to the Land hikes and events that we have throughout the year. We do ask for people to sign up for those. Again, they're free, but we want you to RSVP so that we make sure that we can accommodate the number of people that are going to be coming to the event. So coming up, we have our Gardens and Gazing hike, an event that is it's a partnership that we do with the Franciscan Sisters, and it's up on their St. Joseph Ridge property. You'll have an opportunity to view their extensive vegetable garden and then hike on their really beautiful property with an overlook. And when you return in the evening as it gets dark, the Astronomical Society will be there and we'll do some stargazing. That one is always very, very popular. But if you can't make that and you're interested in stargazing, we have another opportunity in October on the 11th at our Tunnelville Cliffs State Natural Area, and there will be a prairie walk and stargazing at that event as well. But just going to our website, checking out what's coming up and what interests you, you will also find on that site the Trail Trek Challenge, which is a self-guided hiking program where you can sign up, and if you participate by just hiking 5 of the suggested properties that we've got listed, you will get a prize at the end of the year. We'll send you a sticker acknowledging your accomplishment. There are 17 or 18 possibilities across our 9 counties, so it's something for everyone to enjoy. It's fun if you want to take family and sign up together, or a group of friends who like to hike together. You can sort of form a team and go out and do those hikes on your own time when it's convenient for you, which is a really nice option as well. And then, of course, we have all of our volunteer work opportunities, parties, gatherings, events. Coming up in October, we have a couple. One is on our Kaplan property, which is up in the La Crosse Blufflands. That's a Leave No Trace work party. And then later in October, we have at our Plum Creek Conservation Area, another really amazing property that we have near Wazika. That'll be habitat restoration. And our newest acquisition, Wandering Rock State Natural Area, and that is up near Nelson. Again, habitat restoration. We've been working on cleaning up trails there, and we want to make sure that we're working on some of the habitat projects on that property too. We've had a lot of volunteers turn out for that, and just a little fun fact, but you can stop afterwards and have some ice cream at the Creamery in Nelson, so that's always a fun one to sign up for.
So that's pretty exciting, all the different opportunities. I mean, people could stay pretty busy if they wanted to, just partaking in the Conservancy events and activities out there. It sounds like you have something going on all the time. That's really encouraging. What are some of the biggest challenges facing the Conservancy today?
Well, I think, like so many nonprofits, there's always the capacity issue. So we didn't touch really on the staff very much, but we have a team of 12 full-time professionals on our staff. And Abby and I can both attest to the fact that when we joined our current roles, we had three staff back then, and we had a long list of property owners who wanted to protect their land. Now we have 12 people, and we have an even longer list of property owners who would like to protect their land. And that's just because people care so deeply about our driftless area. But in order to support that staff, we need to have financial support. We have, as Abby said, close to 6,000 acres to care for, so we need volunteers. There's a place for everyone on our team, and I just encourage people to find their place within the Conservancy, and by all means, if they have questions, contact us. I'm happy to get on a phone call with people, as is Abby.
So in that vein, I have time for one more question, and that is, if you had to pick one thing you wished everyone understood about the Conservancy, what would that be?
I'll say something, but Abby, do chime in. I think the biggest misconception is if you have your land protected with a conservation easement, that the Conservancy owns it, and that's not true.
Okay, good. Well, thank you for clearing that up. And with that, I want to thank my guests for today, Carol and Abby from the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. This is Frank Dravis, Conversations host for WDRT 91 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin.